It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. You know, I always have things to think about during the week, and it kind of prompts my Sunday shows this week. We got a new hunting club at the Research Center, and they're nice folks, really enjoy them, enjoyed being with them. They had lots of questions about what we were doing with our research. They were very supportive of that. It's just fun. It's fun to be around them, fun to answer questions. And they were open to thinking about a lot of things. You know, it's we have a long-standing rule on this hunting preserve that you don't shoot rattlesnakes, for example. We have a healthy rattlesnake population, and we have names for them, and they just sit there and look at you. Kind of fun. And nobody thought that was a big deal. They thought, well, okay. And some people said, boy, you know, I'm really interested in snakes. It's fun. It's fun when you get in your hunting club and you got a whole bunch of people and you got a whole bunch of dialogues going on. But it made me think, because with hunting, as with gardening, we sometimes know what we know. We often know what we know because we read some book or magazine written in some other place, and we completely forget where we are, and we completely forget the fact that things have been going on here long before we started plowing this place up, and that there's all sorts of food out there, amazingly enough for deer. You got to wonder how deer survived before we started planting clover, don't you? So we had some discussion about it, and I could show some of the hunting club places where the deer had been browsing, and the deer were eating the stew, just eating the stew out of the native plants. And the junk that had been seeded in, they were ignoring. And it's funny because, you know, everybody has a funny way of proving that we got a handle on what deer are eating. And so one of the old methods was to plant something in an open field, a small open field, and then put a cage in the center of that, a little wire cage that the deer couldn't eat inside of. And the wire cage sat about 2 feet high and was about 2 feet wide by 2 feet wide, little small cage. And indeed, grass would grow up through the cage, and the area around it was eaten, because deer got to eat something. They're going to eat whatever's in that plot, because it's got sunlight, and the rest of the woods around it were thick and cloddy and didn't have any sunlight, and there wasn't as much forage there. They're going to eat something there. If you had put that cage over native plants, as we often do when we're trying to exclude deer browse, because deer can eat up native plants so bad you never even get to see them bloom. Wild thing with things like lilies. Same thing would happen. Doesn't prove anything. Except the deer get hungry, and they like plants that are growing in full sunlight. And that are at browse height, at the size of a deer's head. We forget to think like animals sometimes when we're thinking about things like quails and birds in your yard. You got to think, you know, how big's a bird? How big's a quail? How big is his, how high is he going to eat? Is he right there on the ground? If everything is 10 or 12 or 15 feet taller than the quail, the quail's got nothing to eat. Sort of the same thing with deer. And what's interesting about deer is if you're out there thinking about deer and you want to see more deer in your yard and you want to see more deer in your hunting lands, and you say, oh, well, I got to go get one of these seed mixes from some kind of special seed place, and it's going to cost me X amount of dollars, and I don't want to spend that much, so I'm going to get the cheapest seed mix, and surely I hope it works, and it's probably got all kind of weed seeds in it that you don't actually do not want in your yard. And there's no even guarantee that the stuff that's supposed to be in there is going to be any better for the deer, and most of the time it isn't, than the stuff that was just growing wild in your yard. So, I say to the hunting club, as I say to you, you got to know where you are. You got to think about where you are. And you got to look and see. And you got to discover it. Because one of the problems is that here in Alabama, we don't write very often about where we are. We don't write books about where we are. I hope some of you will write a book about where you are here in Alabama and Mississippi and Northwest Florida and not depend on other people to write those books. And I hope those books will be well informed and thoughtful. And I hope you'll look around and pay attention to what you see. And you can help you can help other folks in the process. But it's really interesting to go out and just observe and look and think. One of the things, and so I'm talking to the hunting club, and those of you who aren't really interested in hunting, that is fair. We can talk about being sportsmanlike and all that. I'm not a sportsman. I don't mind killing deer. Please believe me. But I'm not a sportsman, and it's not fun for me to hunt. Hunting's work. It's something I would do if I needed to. Let me just say, I understand that some of you want to hunt and you want to be sportsmen. You want to kill deer. Well, think about this. Think about this. What deer are eating in winter is not grass. And you're out there planting grass. And they may eat clover, but you know what I'm seeing deer eat in winter? It's things that we barely even think about. It's things like euonymus, strawberry bush, hearts of bustin', hearts of burstin', whatever you want to call it. We don't have good common names. We get the same common name to every plant. But if you don't know strawberry bush, if you don't know hearts of burstin', they're all the same plant, hearts of bustin', euonymus americana, you don't know one of the most important deer foods all year round, particularly in winter. I mean, they browse the stew out of it. They browse the stew out of it. And there are many plants we don't think about that are widely used. Tie-tie, for example. Cliftonia, I'm sorry, Cerilla, Racemosa. What I would call summer tie-tie because it blooms in summer. Deer will browse. You know, there's been studies where they're browsing somewhere between 30 and 50% of the stems. And tie-tie is palatable, if you're getting good rains in summer, well into the fall season. Sourwood, great plant for deer to eat. They love it. There's been studies where in the mountains where young sourwood stems, the deer are eating 75% of the stems. Sumac, they love it. Poison ivy, they love it. They eat tons of it. Honeysuckle, they love it. Winter honeysuckle. Not winter honeysuckle, but just regular old Japanese honeysuckle. Deer love these things. They eat these things, but we don't think about that when we're managing for deer. We think about, oh, well, here's a seed mix. I'm going to plant this. And all you would have to do to make that really palatable in winter is go in and trim those shrubs, those bushes, in late summer, right about now. They'll resprout, be great for the deer. I think we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that. And your garden. And what deer prefer and don't prefer in your garden.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Oh, I've been thinking about what's in the woods. You know, it's such a shame that we know so little about what's out there. And I picked up, I think if you're in deep South Alabama, you're not going to see this very much. You're going to see it in Conecuh County. You're going to see it in Monroe County. You're going to see it all the way up to Wilcox County and through Birmingham and into North Alabama. And that's hazelnut. And it's, you can really get into dense stands of hazelnut. And it's really a great plant and the deer love it. And the squirrels love it. And the chipmunks love it. They all use it in different ways. The deer will just, oh man, they'll eat the leaves and twigs off of it. And you don't even get the fruit. But if the fruit manages to get on there, the deer are going to love it. Would people like that? Yeah, actually they would. And it's amazing that we don't think about, when you're thinking about all the things you can grow in your garden, we don't think about hazelnut. Because if we're thinking about hazelnut, we're reading some magazine about hybrid hazelnuts from Europe that have American hazelnut in there because it makes them more prolific and it cuts down, it increases their disease resistance, and it's arguable it might actually make them taste better. But we don't grow our own native hazelnut, and I can't tell you why. It's bizarre. It's weird. It's maybe, I don't know why, but they're delicious. They're not as big as the ones you find at, you know, Fresh Market or wherever you go to buy hazelnuts, but they're quite delicious and they're quite good. And if you're going to grow blueberries, why aren't you growing hazelnuts? I can't tell you why. They're quite good, but the deer love them and the wildlife love them. And we never talk about hazelnuts. It's a great plant. It's a great food. It's a wonderful thing. There's lots of other plants that we don't think about that are so important if you're thinking about a food plot. Oh, heavens to Betsy, for deer. And basically what a food plot should be is sunlight. That's the most important thing to put in your food plot. If you don't have sunlight in your food plot, you've missed the point. And if you have sunlight, almost anything you do there is going to be better for the attracting deer than areas that get too much shade. Putting sunlight into your food plot, that's the most. And then what you plant is probably less important. And, in fact, it's probably not important at all if you really understand your native vegetation. And so deer are not actually eating that much in winter. It's true. They actually do most of their eating in spring and summer, and there's another peak in fall for a variety of reasons. Fall, oh, I shouldn't say fall, because it's basically hurricane summer along the Gulf Coast would be the time that deer are eating a lot, and you're going to see them out foraging on a lot of stuff just before deer season opens. And it's not that they're eating on purpose before deer season opens, gun season opens. It's just that that's the way it is. And there's lots to eat then, and there's lots of reasons for them to pick up on forage then. And so those are the peak times when you're really trying to get deer to eat things. So if you've got sunlight and you want a healthy population of deer, and it's not hard to get a healthy population of deer, but if you want a more healthy population of deer, if you believe that somehow the most important thing to do is to shoot antlers and not deer, then you're really going to be wanting to concentrate on feeding them in spring and fall and a bit in summer and a tiny little bit in winter. The only thing you're doing in winter is just trying to get them moving around so you can shoot them. If you try to shoot over a field, you know, we had this thing called baiting in Alabama, you're going to be sadly disappointed because the deer are going to come out at night and they're going to eat the field and then they're going to leave, particularly the bucks who are super cautious. So if there's any benefit to a field at all that I can hear from to a green field in terms of shooting the deer, it's that it helps, it gives deer reason to move around a little bit. And you probably won't shoot the deer over the field. You're probably going to shoot the deer, I'm told by a lot of people who are doing this, well away from that field, but on a path that the deer are using to get to the field. So what do we do in winter? It's a lot of fun to think about, but some browse there, some new growth, and that's why I'm telling you, think now if you're deer hunters, about if you've got woody browse on the edge of places, go in and cut down the tie-tie. Cut down the sourwoods right now. Cut down things like sassafras right now. Cut it down so that you're getting new growth. Certain types of oaks, live oaks are terrible for deer. I think it's pretty well demonstrated that they don't eat live oaks very much. It's become a terrible weed. I think they probably don't eat as much water oak either. But they do eat things like chinkapin oak and a lot of other oaks, probably white oak as well. You just got to know how to recognize those things. And the browse has to be down at their eye level, at their eye level. You know, things that we don't like, things like greenbrier. They love greenbrier, and they will eat the stew out of it in early winter when gun season starts. Cut it down, bring the sprouts down to deer level, to head level, and you're going to see them browse those sprouts like crazy. I'm sorry to do this, but I had to think about it this past week. I've had to think a lot about deer this past week. I've had to think a lot about hunting, and people are starting to think about hunting, and they're thinking about, how am I going to manage for deer? Well, if you're going to manage for deer, think about the fact that deer have been here for, 5 million years or so, at least in their modern form. That's a long time. And basically, they've grown up. They've learned to live. Their livelihood is built around these native plants. So why wouldn't you know them if you wanted to manage deer? Why wouldn't you understand those native plants if you wanted to understand deer? And why would you displace those native plants, particularly because they're going to need them at times when you're not paying attention, honestly, in spring, in summer, in early fall, in hurricane summer, September, August, September, October. Something to think about. Just something to think about. B Dark says she finally got some babies on my cantaloupes and watermelons. And you know, I think this is beginning to be a good time. We want to, if you can get your cantaloupes and watermelons through this wet season, you're not going to get the best quality cantaloupes and watermelons anywhere in Alabama, really, in July. Certainly not on the Gulf Coast because of all the rain and the high temperatures, which can discourage flowering and seed set. But if you can get them through this, you know, and they begin to develop those small fruits in early August, they're going to mature at a time, particularly watermelons, cantaloupes too. Maybe you want your cantaloupes to start maturing in September, to start developing small fruits in September. Those fruits are going to develop during the drier season in Alabama, which is September through October and into November. Yeah, you're going to get rains. If we get a bad you know, if we get a bad hurricane season, we can get sporadic rains through September. But in general, there's also long, dry periods. And that sweetens those melons a lot. And it also keeps the night temperatures lower. We'll talk about melons here a little bit more.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Yeah, all right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. From deer to melons, that's fun. Something has been nibbling on my melons. It doesn't make me happy. You know, I think it's some kind of field mouse, field rat, cotton mouse, hispid cotton mouse, rat, is what I think's happening. Some of you may see that problem with roof rats or other things, just nibbling on the outside of it. I don't know what's going to do to the watermelon in the long haul. I hate to see that. Got to figure out what to do about it. It's not like you can put a net around it because, well, it's going to get a lot bigger, right? It's not like I could put one of those little wedding bags around it, the organza bags that Bruce uses and so successfully on tomatoes because they just get too big. I don't know what I'm going to do about that, but a lot of people are beginning to see cantaloupes and watermelons come in, and they're sending me pictures. Josh in Fowl River, Be Dark is seeing her cantaloupes and watermelons come in. I like to get those cantaloupes and watermelons planted at the right time. Time it so that you're maturing in late September, October, November, and they're going to be particularly delicious. Particularly delicious. Because it's going to be drier. And most melons are actually from drier climates in Africa, Europe, Asia. And they're gonna really develop well when it's drier, and they're gonna get a lot more sweetness. So one thing to think about. You know, one of the other things that used to happen in Mobile, and I think it probably still does a little bit, is that Mobile would try, of course now we barely do agriculture anymore in South Alabama, but at one time Mobile was famous for its watermelons because it got them to the market very early on. And to get things to the market very early on, they had to work hard at it. They had to work a little harder at it, but you could plant earlier in Mobile and Washington County and Baldwin counties and up into Washington County. And then you could get it into the market very early on before anybody else did. And you'd have those watermelons ready for July. 1st of July, if you wanted to do that. But one of the cool things was is that they developed, those watermelons developed during what is traditionally one of our drier seasons, May and June, along the Gulf Coast. And it's hard to say that's a super dry season. In North Alabama, it varies. But it can be a little drier up there, too. So timing melons so that they're maturing during the best and driest, during the driest times of the year to get the best sweetness, the most sweetness. Something to do. Something to do. Let's see here. What we got, a caller, Phil? I'm listening. Who's calling, Phil? Hey, this Bill, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Who am I talking to?
Samantha Autry.
Samantha, how are you? What's
I'm good,
up?
How are you?
Good.
I am getting started on growing blueberries and blackberry bushes. they're real small, and I want to get advice on how to care for them and to get them to grow big where they can produce.
Yeah, okay. Two very different growing techniques. Let's talk about the blueberries. Have you already planted them?
I have. I've got, there's probably three or four different varieties.
Mm-hmm, that's a good thing. You know, can you tell me the varieties real quick? Do you know them off the top of your head?
I know I've got an Austin, Premier, I want to say, I think it's Brightwell.
Brightwell, yes, ma'am. That's one of them.
And Georgia Gem.
Georgia Gem. Okay, good. So, Georgia Gem is a little different than the others. And it's a little harder to manage. But Austin Premier and Brightwell, it's good that you've got those paired up. They'll pollinate each other. They're rabbit eye blueberries, and they're good. Let's talk about blueberries first. Blueberries are hard to establish. I will tell you, they are hard to establish. Once they get established, you almost can't kill them. They're very good. So those first 2 years are pretty delicate. One thing that blueberries need, because they have a shallow root system and they're used to growing, at least the varieties that we have, they're used to growing in soils that don't have a lot of water in the top layer. And so if you plant them in a place where the soil stays wet in the top layer of soil, they're going to struggle. At the same time, you need lots of water. I know this is weird. You need lots of water to get them established because they don't have much of a root system, and they have a kind of a delicate root system that doesn't draw water very well until they're really well established. So the important thing to do is when you plant those blueberries, plant them. When did you plant these? Has it been a long time since you planted them?
Some of them have probably been in the ground over a year, and then some are freshly planted within the last probably 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah. Okay. So here's what I do when I plant blueberries. And we can compare notes and see what you've done with yours. So you got the container with the soil, right?
I don't plant
blueberries so that the top of the soil in the container is the level. I do not want that to be the same level as the soil in the ground. In fact, I want the soil in the container to sit at least an inch, and a couple of inches is probably better, and maybe 3 inches is just fine too. I want the top of that soil in the container to sit 1 to 3 inches above the surrounding soil.
Okay.
So it's kind of like pop open a bottle of wine and you're trying to get the cork back in there and it won't go all the way back in.
Yes, exactly.
That's kind of what you're wanting with the blueberry. And then you can take, and this is pretty important, I'd try to find some just pure pine bark. And I don't know, you don't want any lime in it. You don't want anything else in it except just pure pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail. If you can find some of that, and even if some pieces are a little bigger, that's okay. I know, just not anything big chunks of it. But just build up the soil then to the level of that blueberry sticking out of the ground. Clean all the grass out around it. Crack the soil around it. Put that pine bark on it in a little ring about 3 feet around the blueberry. At least. 4 feet's even better. Don't let the grass grow up there because you're going to have a hard time managing it. So get rid of the grass, put that there, and then just make sure that it's watered frequently. If you're in Mobile or Baldwin counties and Washington counties, anywhere down there, the water is going to be just fine. Sometimes if you're farther north, the water can have so much lime in it that it's a problem, but you'll be fine with just regular watering. And make sure you don't have to water it You just want to make sure that that water gets right there where the crown of the plant is. You're not watering the soil around it. I wouldn't put any fertilizer on it until it's well established. It doesn't need a lot of fertilizer.
Okay.
And you just want to keep it alive with the water. Now, once it starts producing berries, you might put a little bit of fertilizer on it, but I wouldn't use Miracle-Gro for a variety of reasons. Not on a plant like that. I would try to find something that was a slow-release fertilizer, or I would use something like cottonseed meal. Something that is a nice slow-release fertilizer that lasts a long time, that you only apply once a year, and you'll be better off doing it that way. Never put lime on it, ever.
Okay. And in the wintertime, do I need to cover those up?
Do not cover them. They're going to be just fine. They're going to be completely healthy.
Okay.
They are totally hardy. And then at some point, you'll have to, when they get big on you, if you get them through this sort of early stage and they get big on you, you're going to need to prune them. But that's probably about, I'm going to say, somewhere between 5 and 10 years from now.
Okay, we got a long while for that.
So call me back in 5 to 10 years, and we'll talk about pruning. But the point is, they don't need a lot of pruning when they're early. Here's one thing that they may need, and the Georgia Gem may be particularly sensitive to this. Georgia Gem's a slightly different kind of blueberry. They may set more fruit, particularly when they're young, they may set more fruit than the bush can handle. And so for the first 2 or 3 years, and this is going to be so hard, strip off some of the fruit so that it doesn't fruit itself to death.
To strip off some of the green while it's young.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So blueberries are pretty good. It's just the soil matters and the drainage matters, but that you want it to be well drained. You never want water to be retained around the crown of the plant. You never want to plant it deep. You never want water to be retained around the crown of the plant, but you want it to be nice and moist. And the best way to maintain that balance is to have lots of organic matter in the form of pine bark around the plant. And that works well. And then you're going to still have to water it for the first couple of years. After the first couple of years, you may never have to water it again if it's well established. They're pretty tough customers once they're established. So there's the blueberries. Blackberries. I'll tell you, my dad had blackberries, and I watched him manage those blackberries, and it's not hard to establish blackberries at all. You just need full sun. But pruning can become really important with blackberries. And so establishing the blackberries is pretty easy. Pruning them so that you're pruning them at the right time can be really important too. I did not feel like reading a book about pruning blackberries, so I'm going to tell you what I did when we get back.
Yes,
and the rain pours down like a holy waterfall over the Gulf.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right, so we went through the matter of blueberries. Now we're on the subject of getting blackberries to grow. You still there?
Yes, sir.
All right. So here we are back with the blackberry question. Blackberries are super easy to establish. the one thing I would say about blackberries is you don't want a lot of weeds growing in the beds. So be sure before you plant them to get rid of the weeds, because once they start growing, you're not going to be able to get in there and get the weeds out very easily. So do everything you can to get rid of the weeds before you plant. And after that, you've got to ask me for tips on how to get rid of weeds in the blackberries, and I'm going to tell you, work at it. Because it's just going to be work. And you probably have a thornless variety.
Yes, sir.
Once they get established, they are... The only thing that really needs to be done is you got to prune out the old stuff. The stuff that's already fruited isn't going to fruit again.
What's the best time of year to do that?
Yeah, and so it's and for most blackberries, I'm not going to get into primocane blackberries, and you probably don't have a primocane blackberry, but don't worry if you do, because it gets really complicated. For most blackberries, you want to make sure there's two seasons of growth. Or you're not going to get blackberries. So as soon as they produce, one thing you can do is go in and just mow the whole thing down. Mow it down to the ground. And they're going to resprout like crazy. And that's okay. If you have a primocane variety, it's possible that they'll refruit again. Some of them may refruit again in fall. But really what you're trying to do is get the crop ready for next year. And so again, you want the vegetative growth, and then you want that second year growth to actually start producing blackberries. Now, there are more complicated ways of doing it. You might want to, some people might prune again in spring, but that's a lot of trouble.
At this point, I need to go ahead and mow them down for the season.
If they're thick, did they produce many blackberries this year?
They produced a few, not a lot, but they did produce some.
Yeah, so here's what I would do. Since they didn't produce many blackberries this year, just go ahead and prune out those canes that fruited. Just prune those out. And next year, you can do the same. Next year. But it probably is just as easy in the South to just mow them down next year. And you don't mow them super short. I don't know if I'd use a lawnmower. I might go in with a weed whacker or something, or pruners or whatever. Just prune the whole thing down to about 6 inches, 8 inches. And they'll be fine. They'll come back and they'll fruit the next year. And that's how I managed my dad's, because I didn't feel like the blackberries deserved that much more attention than that. So it's good. I mean, don't make it too complicated with blackberries. Of course, the other thing with blackberries is to look for wild blackberries, and then you don't have to think about it too much at all. You just go pick them.
Well, the thornless variety is good for when the kids want to stick their hands in.
That's right. And so they can stick their hands in and grab them. And I would recommend that. Now, fertilizer on blackberries, they do respond to fertilizer, and you're in the sandier soils, and they also respond to a little bit of lime. You could throw a little bit of lime on them. What's a little bit of lime? If your yard has not been limed ever, I'd get about a cup of lime for every 4 to 5 feet of bed, 6 feet of bed, 4 to 6 feet of bed, and just sprinkle that lime broadly across there. And that'll help. They may want a little bit of fertilizer because they're having to do a lot of growing. And for blackberries, just any fertilizer that has nitrogen and potassium in it is a good thing. You don't need, if you could find something, Miracle-Gro is fine. It would be an expensive way to it would be an expensive way to fertilize blackberries, but you could just use Miracle-Gro if that's a simple thing. If you want to look around a little bit, you want something with a moderately high nitrogen level and a moderately high...
What would you recommend?
The funny thing is that who makes it doesn't matter. What matters is what the ingredients say. So you're going to look on the label and you're going to see on the label, if it's by a reputable place, it's going to tell you on the label how much nitrogen it has, how much phosphorus it has, and how much potassium it has. And there'll be three numbers. So in the old days, people used to use 10, 10, 10, for example, which means it was 10% nitrogen, 10% phosphorus, and 10% potassium. The problem is that that middle number, you probably don't need a lot of it. And if you get too much of it, it's a problem. So what you would really like to have is something like 10, 0, 10, or 10, 0, 5, or 15, 0, 5. So, and who makes it? It doesn't matter. If it's a quick release fertilizer, you probably want to put it on as soon as you're through pruning them in summer, as soon as they're through producing, and as soon as you cut them down, you want to put it on then. And so you're picking them, let's say you pick them in June, May or June. When did you pick yours this year?
Oh, I would have to say probably May or June. There's no more on them right now.
Yeah. So the issue is, this is a good reason not to prune this time of year with a heavy pruning. But go ahead and put a little fertilizer on. And you want to prune them just as soon as they're through fruiting in June, and then put fertilizer on them. Now, go ahead this year. Go ahead and put that fertilizer on them now. And you might put a little more fertilizer on them next spring as they're beginning to flower. Not too heavily.
So it's late to prune them this summer.
You can prune out the old canes this summer. Prune out the ones where you got blackberries. Prune those out this summer. And then wait, and the rest of those canes should produce next year.
Okay.
But it's getting a little late to prune this time of year, I think. You might
right,
do
then
okay.
I had another question that wasn't related to blueberries or blackberries. I have some peach trees. I planted them in the ground.
And we have to wait now until after the news to talk about it. Why don't you, we'll come back.
A little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it. On down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico. On down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Oh my goodness, lots of questions. Lots of questions. Do we still have a caller on the line here? Folks, do we have a caller on the line? Okay, apparently not. Okay, good. She's going to call back next Sunday. Thanks, Steve. So the question was about peaches. Oh, and I hate having to answer questions about peaches because they're always going to be hard, folks. I don't know. You want another opinion on peaches? Go talk to John Olive, who's probably going to give you the same opinion I give you. They're just hard. They're not well adapted to this climate for the most part. We probably need to go back and start over with peaches if we're going to grow them in the deep south. And you're going to grow them in yards, and you don't want to spray them all the time, and you don't want them to be... I mean, commercial growers have such a hard time with peaches. And finding the right peach for the right climate, oh, man, what a difficult thing. I mean, I can tell you what to do, and I can kind of give you a sense of how you're going to have to prune them, and I'm going to give you a kind of a sense of how you're going to have to spray them, but you're going to have to make sure first you start with you have to be very careful about the varieties you get with peaches. For those of you who want to get started in peaches, please, you've got to ask me at least what kind of variety. Let me tell you, let's just start here. For those who want to do peaches, I can only warn you that if you're annoyed by having to deal with a lawn that won't cooperate, oh boy, are you going to be annoyed by those peaches. They're going to be really difficult. There's just no question about it. And it's because all modern peaches are very disease prone. And they got all kind of other issues. And your fruit's going to get all ugly looking, and you're going to wonder, how do I stop this? And I'm going to say, well, you got to spray it. And you get a summer like this one where we get rain all the time, and you're going to have to spray it virtually every week. And those sprays are pretty toxic, quite honestly. And you might as well buy your peaches from a commercial grower, because they're not going to be that much better if you're having to manage it this way. So just a word of caution, but if you're growing peaches, and I understand that there's a desire for peaches. I have a desire for peaches at a certain time of year. If you're going to grow them, you got to look at how long your winters are, how many days below 45 degrees your winter has. That's the simple way of looking at it. And actually, how many days between about 35 and 45 degrees your winter has. And if you're on the Gulf Coast, that ain't many days. You may have a few days that are really cold, but that doesn't matter. In fact, once it gets below about 25 degrees, it doesn't count anymore. You really want days between about 30 and 32 and 35 degrees and 45 degrees. Somewhere in there, you want the number of days to match where you are. And on the Gulf Coast, those days are, somewhere around, in North Mobile County, it may be as much as 600 hours, maybe most years. But in South Mobile County or in South Baldwin County, it may only be 200 hours or 300 hours per year. And if you get Bella, Georgia, and Bella, Georgia requires 800 hours, I think, Bella, Georgia, I think it's probably more like 1,200 hours. It needs 1,200 hours of chilling. I didn't look it up. It's off the top of my head. But let's say you get Bella, Georgia, and it needs somewhere between 800 and 1,200 hours of chilling. Well, you are going to be in a fix, because it ain't never going to produce fruit for you, except in one exceptional winter out of 10. And maybe now, not even that. Because a lot of temperate fruits like peaches and apples, to some degree blueberries, not so much, but peaches and apples, pears to some degree, but particularly peaches and apples and plums are going to be very specific about the number of hours they require in winter that are between 35 and 45 hours. So you got to match that, and you got to understand where you are. If you're in central Alabama, you're not going to grow the same peach varieties that we grow on the Gulf Coast. So if you like a peach variety that they're growing in Chilton County, you better move to Chilton County. And even there, they're having some problems because the climate's changing. Oh, I shouldn't say that out loud, should I? But it is. And so they're having problems. They're having problems with late freezes. And so they're going to have to adapt their varieties because they're coming, they're getting winter chilling too soon. They're coming out and then it's just a mess. So you got to match that very carefully. Huntsville is a whole nother world when it comes to which peach varieties work there and which peach varieties work in Mobile. So as you're thinking about peaches, you got to think about really hard about where you are. And if you got a pen pal up, if you got a Facebook person up there in Minnesota and or Kansas or those really wonderful places, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois, mountains of North Carolina, and they're saying, oh man, this is a great peach. You ought to try this. You got to say to them, I don't live there. I don't live where you do. I got to do what works for me. I got to grow what works for me. And that means you got to do a little bit of study and you got to do a little bit of thought. So if anybody wants to talk more about peaches, I'm happy to, and varieties and how all that works. And if none of that made any sense, you just feel free to call me. Okay. And we'll talk about it. All right. Let's see here. What have we got? We got any other text? Jaybird, Grandma had a Freestone peach when I was little. Yeah. I see neighbors, but Jaybird also said, I see neighbors planting peaches and I just laugh. You know, I don't laugh. I don't laugh because I completely understand the desire to grow peaches. I understand it. It is absolutely a normal human desire to grow peaches. It's just you got to know that peaches just are a lot of work in Alabama because it's not a natural climate for them. And because we bred peaches to be even more vulnerable and more susceptible. It's kind of a sad thing, but we have. And so it can be tricky. Let's see here what we got. All right, let's get back here to our conversations. Freestone peaches, non-freestone peaches, cling peaches as they're called. Is one better than the other? I think freestone peaches are easier to eat, and a lot of people like them. They're also a little harder to grow in general. Maybe as George Wallace would say, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. But there's a bit of difference. Some of the clingstones can be some old varieties of clingstones, and they do seem to be a little tougher. How much tougher is hard to say, but I can tell you that, Aunt Mary Weaver, up in Washington County, on the Washington Mobile County line, she had a peach that was just an amazing thing. I hadn't seen it, I hadn't seen her, and she's gone now, but bless her, but she had a beautiful peach. It was massive, and it produced every year. But it was something that she found.
Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round all the seven oceans.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 1065.
Welcome back. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Question from a while back. How do you differentiate between Gardonia and Gardolinia? I don't have any idea. I have no idea. It's a Gardolinia is a hybrid that I just honestly don't know a lot about. Gordonia. I know what it looks like. I think I could probably distinguish, and it's probably going to have something to do with, I don't know. I'd have to look it up. But the other thought was the MBG, the milkweed is blooming and forming pods at the longleaf at Mobile Botanical Gardens. And I see several varieties here. Over on the one of those is a Humifusa, which is one of my favorites. And I get that right. I think I did. Asclepias Humifusa, which is what is the common name for that? But it is just a bizarre looking plant, and it is so neat looking, and it is even neater looking when the fruits are on it, but just as beautiful with the flowers, but the leaves are just astonishing. Looks like there might be some amplexicaulis here. I can't quite tell. And it looks like the other milkweed we call butterfly weeds. So quite a lot going on with milkweeds at Mobile Botanical Gardens. Not just one type, but many types. Oh, don't go to Brazil for your milkweeds. We have such good ones here. So tropical milkweeds, not so much. So you'd think that I would get a little bit of pushback when I don't say nice things about peaches. But then Jim in Georgetown, I mean, Jim's willing to give me pushback. And he says, as far as peaches go, we tried growing the same variety as Kimbuck. Kimbuck's a commercial grower down in Biola Battery. They flowered but never produced. I got more late freezes here than he does there. I grew up on peaches. I gave up on peaches 15 plus years ago. And what Jim in Georgetown is saying is that peaches are very, very sensitive to exactly the climate that you plant them in. And this has been one of the problems that peach growers have been having, because we've had some changes in climate. And it's not, oh, you want everything to be super simple, and you want to say, oh, everything's going to get warmer, and we're going to be able to grow avocados in Mobile, and a lot of you pretend that, and we're going to grow limes in Mobile. That's not the way it's going to work. I know you like to pretend you can grow limes in Mobile, but climate change isn't going that direction. What's happening is that most nights are getting warmer, which means it gets to be, even in winter, which means we have to be much more careful about the varieties of peaches we pick so that they don't require a lot of winter chilling. And then the problem is that many of those will actually flower much earlier in spring. And boom, we get these late frosts, which are getting later and later. Oh, it's just really tricky. So, and that's partly about climate, but it's partly just about peaches are finicky. And so it's really hard to get a variety that works for you. I could say, oh, go and get the Peninsula or Florida varieties that don't require much winter chilling. And boom, then you get hit by a late frost. And I don't even think the frosts are the biggest issue by any means. There's lots of other things to do. So Jim's giving up on peaches has spared him a lot of anxiety. Gives him more time to grow the really fun things, like the nice display of peppers that he put out there. He's got such cool peppers. And Jim, I'm going to try some of them peppers this year, next year. I may just go ahead after today's show and order some of those. They look so pretty. And they look interesting, and I'm going to have to try some of them. I'm going to get, you know, one thing, folks, I will say, it's about time to start thinking about fall if you're on the Gulf Coast. It's way past time. I planted my first, if you're in Central or North Alabama, you definitely want to start thinking about planting your cabbages and planting your broccoli and getting them ready to go in the ground. Definitely now's the time. August, October. Yeah, it's about the time. And, you don't have a lot of August, September, October, excuse me. There's another month in there. And, so you plant them now, and they're going to be ready to start producing sometime around October 15, October 20 between October 15th and October 30th, which is kind of perfect for cabbages, kind of perfect for broccoli. And then you're going to have hard frost in North Alabama sometime around the 1st of November. You're going to have some frost. They may be hard, maybe not, but you're going to have them about the 1st of November. Cover them a little bit. They'll be producing all through November because most of your nights are going to be still be warm. They'll produce right into December. Spend a little more time covering them in South Alabama, covering them through December, January, February. You're going to have cabbages. You're going to have broccoli all winter long, but they're not going to grow much during the December and January days. So you want to go ahead and get them in now. Don't wait too late to get them started. Get those started. But here's the other thing, and this is what I want to come back to. This is the time of year to start peppers. Okay, now let me explain that. The peppers that Jim's growing and a lot of the peppers I'm growing are not annuum peppers. They're not the kind of typical banana peppers, whatever, bell peppers, whatever. Oh, there's a bunch of them. Ancho poblanos. It's not those types. It's peppers that are from Central and South America that are really sweet, really great tasting. Some of them moderately hot, some of them really hot, some of them not hot at all. But they don't start producing until later in the year. But they will survive the winter really well. Some of them will actually survive the winter in the ground in Mobile, amazingly enough. But if you start them now in containers and just overwinter those containers, they'll be ready to go in the ground next spring. You don't have to have them grow super big or anything like that now. Just get them started, which is what I'm going to do. It's easy to start peppers now. It is so hard to start peppers in spring. I mean, you got to go to all this trouble, and then you get damping off, and you get all kind of problems, and you just now you just throw them in a decent container and decent well-drained soil, put them outside in this heat and rain, and they are going to grow like – they're going to germinate and grow like crazy. It's going to happen really quick. So this is a great time to start peppers. I'll just give you some advice, particularly if you're growing the ajis and some of the others that we've been talking about. Great time to do it. Go ahead and get them started. That means you're going to have to probably overwinter them in containers. Some varieties, maybe not, but most varieties you probably want to overwinter them in containers. Doesn't have to be a big container. And you don't have to really push them to grow hard. Just give them a little bit of sunlight during the winter. And then plant them next spring. That's my advice. Love doing peppers that way. You know, think of them like, you know, like you're growing impatiens in a container or something. Just like that. Just put them in a container. Let them grow up and then plant them out in spring. And you're going to start producing those peppers very early on. Really nice. All right. B-Dark says, I saw olives with fruit in Summerdale, Alabama this week. Yeah. Yeah. It sort of reminds me that olives and peaches come from the same part of the world, except olives are even more particular. So what is the deal? I don't know. Yeah, can you get peaches to bloom? Can you get peaches to fruit? Yes. Can you get olives to bloom? Can you get them to fruit? Yeah. Gonna be trouble in the long haul.
I'm living in the garden.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right. Jim in Georgetown is scolding me. Jim's only gotten a quarter inch of rain this July. I think some folks along the coast have gotten more. Some folks north of there have gotten a lot. In June, I think everybody got a lot of rain. In Alabama, not so much in Northwest Florida. So it's we came into July with a lot of rain this year, more than usual, throughout Alabama. And that rain has continued in some parts of Alabama, but hasn't continued as much in the southern part of Alabama. And so I would say that most years you're going to get rain every day in July. Apparently this year, a lot of folks in South Alabama are not getting it every day. Will we start getting it? I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It can be these, maybe July is going to turn into a dry month along the Gulf Coast. Maybe climate is going to change that much. I will say, I give advice based on the idea that over the long haul, July is one of the wettest months on the Gulf Coast. It's just behind March, usually. Sometimes it's ahead of March in some places. And the other months are drier. If you can call, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 inches of rain dry, per month. So when I say you want to time your melon harvest for a little later, there it is. Now, if you didn't get a lot of rain this July, maybe one of the things is some of the melons that normally wouldn't be tasting that good or producing that well this time of year are actually going to be okay. So thank you, Jim, for making me restate that in a more comprehensive, better, and thoughtful way. Rain can vary a bit from place to place and from year to year. And I needed to have said that a little more firmly. And I am saying that now. But in general, I would say you're going to do a little better. You're going to do a little better timing your melon harvest for maybe a lot better for September and October or what used to be May, June-ish. And this year, of course, even June didn't work because it rained a lot in June, way more than normal. Most areas on the Gulf Coast. So I don't know. I can't say how the commercial watermelon harvest went. If anybody knows, feel free to weigh in. I'm waiting on some pictures to come in from Jim. I can't see him. I'm not sure what that means. B-Dark, you'll have to tell me what your last comment on peaches means. I think peaches are generally, we generally think of peaches as Persian. I do. They're kind of from that part of the world. Persia would be, Iran. Ever heard of that country? But it's kind of from that part of the world, peaches. Where they were from, at least I think developed modern peaches, the sort of the modern concept of peaches are from there. Where in the world they grew wild, I'm less confident where they originally grew wild, but certainly the modern, and what I mean by that is the larger edible peach was probably first developed in Persia, if I remember correctly. So, let's see. Jaybird. Okay, I kind of got to Jaybird's question. And let me look here just a second. Give me just a second. Jarhead, what do you think about daisies in the beds around the house? They bloom in spring and the base does a good job of shading out weeds. And so daisies, meaning the little white European daisies. If you like them, I think that's a fine thing to do. They are they're pretty aggressive little creatures, the daisies. And he's saying the base does a good job of shedding out weeds, and I'm cool with that too. I think that's a fine thing to do. They're a European daisy, Eurasian daisy. That's okay. Mostly people plant Eurasian things around their house. It could be zinnias. It could be other things. But it seems to me that white English daisies, as they're sometimes called, would be a fine thing to plant around a house. If you didn't want to, you know, if you better than having Gogon. So I think that's a fine idea, Jarhead. Let's see what else we've got. Yeah, and Wayne sent me I got to get to Will here in just a minute. But Wayne sent me a picture of, I have very four old, very mature Formosa azaleas that were planted close together. I took your advice a couple of years ago and cut one down to about 6 inches tall. The ones I've cut back are doing very well, and I plan on doing the same to the other two this year. One picture shows the mature ones. The other shows the one I cut back 2 years ago. Just thought you'd be interested. And the one that he cut back 2 years ago is coming back a bit thicker and less tree-like. Wayne's got these in. There's a lot of shade. Looks like a live oak in the back. There's maybe a maple or something on one side of it. And a good bit of shade. So it's not going to come back super thick, but it is coming back a little thicker. And what we mean by cutting these, why do you want to cut these things back? Please believe me, you're not going to control the height of the azalea by cutting it back. It's always going to be, an 8-foot azalea is always going to want to be an 8-foot azalea. Now you can cut it back so much that it won't bloom. And you might keep it to 4 feet high, and it won't ever bloom because you've cut it back so often, and it's going to bloom poorly, and it's going to look maybe weird and ugly, and you'll keep it at 4 feet, but it won't bloom. So what's the purpose of having an azalea? And then you got to work at it because you have to prune it every couple of years. But we prune azaleas because they get a trunk funk, and sometimes you get parts of the trunk dying out after about 15 years. Usually around 15 years is when that trunk funk starts showing up, 15 to 25 years. So you prune out the heaviest stems, or you can prune the whole thing to the ground, whichever is best at the time. And then you just got to expect it's going to grow back to its normal height, going to be 6 feet tall, usually in a place that doesn't get quite as much shade. Usually be back to a 6 foot height with normal growing conditions within a year. And by the second year, it'll probably be every bit of 8 feet again. So don't cut it back for that reason. But in this case, Wayne got a little bit more density out of his azalea, and it'll be interesting to see how well it blooms. And so keep us posted there, Wayne. Let me go back to a question from Will. Will says, Will, what was that? What variety of winter squash do you recommend for South Baldwin? Oh, gosh, there's so many. They'll all work well. Most of the winter squash are going to work really, really well. Seminole pumpkin is one of my, for flavor, it's just hard to beat Seminole pumpkin, and it's been grown along the Gulf Coast for eons. Longer than Europeans have been here. How's that? It's a very, very old squash here. It's probably derived from Central American and South American squash, but it has been here for a long time, and it does really well. I wouldn't, you know, you don't have to stick with Seminole pumpkin. I like the little pumpkins. They're kind of fun looking. They're not true pumpkins in the sense that they're actually a different species than the pumpkin we usually grow. But you can grow them as little small pumpkins and put them on the stoop during Halloween if you like, and then you can eat them because they're absolutely delicious. Can you carve them? Not really. But they're really good little pumpkins, Seminole pumpkins. We've got a bunch of other winter squash. There's nothing wrong with growing the winter squash that you get at the grocery store, which is, you know, there's a bunch of them out there. So I think they all do pretty well. So have fun. Experiment. I'm experimenting some Chinese pumpkins that I cannot pronounce the name of. I'm working on it. I would recommend it to you if I could remember how to pronounce the name. And the cool thing about that squash is that I can use it as a summer squash and a winter squash. Isn't that neat? So I'll pick the earliest fruits, leave a little more. And we had so many winter squash from that last year that I just thought, God, I wish I'd eat more of these as summer squash. Because, boy, you can get a ton of winter squash out of some of these guys. And they'll grow like crazy. So there it is. One other thing about squash. Can I say one more thing about squash? I had a squash come up from just seed. It was probably crossed out. You know, you don't know. It had one of the winter squash crossed with another winter squash. And I don't know what variety it was. The fruits were definitely different. I don't think they were, we let them get to size and they weren't, you know, the mules love the squash. They wouldn't even eat these. But I decided I'm going to try the little tender young squash. They were incredible. And so one of the things I'm thinking about, particularly with winter squash, is pick them while they're super young. I don't think they get better when they're old. So, you know, I picked a bunch of squash that still had the flowers attached. And the squash was maybe the length of my index finger, maybe the length of my middle finger. It's absolutely delicious. Slice it in half, quarter it. You get a bunch of them. They'll produce a ton of those. And if they're not maturing them, they're going to produce more. And I mixed them with the flowers and I roasted them in a pan and they're just really great. Put them in a pan. Don't even put a lot of oil in there. Just roast them in that pan. Let them get browned on the outside after I've quartered them. And boy, they're really good. They're strangely good. They're creamy and they're really good. Just by the way, just a little tip. But the winter squash are great, and find a winter squash that keeps really well is a really nice thing to have too. Seminole keeps super well. I mean, I've known people to keep Seminole pumpkin on their desk for years and then eat it.
Me and my best friend Lillian in her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio plays.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, so some things to straighten out here. So, you know, olives and peaches are both from this region that we would call sort of the expanded Middle East. Do you think of Iran and Iraq as part of the Middle East? I kind of do. It is tripping over into Asia and India. But that's the region from which we get many things that really love dry climates and that we try to grow here. From Afghanistan, for example, we get hemp, which, you know, people say, oh, you know, I see the pot growing wild in the woods and out. No, you don't. It hates it here in Alabama. It just absolutely hates it here in Alabama. Hemp and marijuana, you can't. It just hates it here. Now, there are people who are trying to grow it commercially, and I don't know how well they've worked out, and you can work at it, and like you can grow anything commercially, but it's not like those are plants that are naturally adapted here. Neither is, and if you were to grow pot here, and grow it in the wild, it'd be the worst, you know, nobody would buy it. I'm not saying you should. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm just saying it's would be really sorry stuff. The and I don't know that you needed to have good stuff either. I'm not defending it either way. I'm just saying peaches and olives are kind of the same way. They're all from that part of the world. Persia is very different. The Persian kingdom of had a different set of fruits. I think they probably played a big role in melon development as well. And it was probably, any rate, it's they're all from that part of the world. Olives have been grown around for a long time, from Spain to Italy to the Middle East. I don't know how much is actually grown in the Middle East now. It may have gotten too dry. I'm not sure for commercial olives there. But Spain still grows a lot. It's now grown in other parts of the world, but generally grown in places that get less rainfall, considerably less rainfall than Alabama. B-Dark also says she trims her blackberries with a weed whacker. Yes. And there was another question about the blackberries. So it sounds to me like somebody had an ever-blooming apricots from Turkey. Thank you. From Rusty and Moss Point is another one from that part of the world that we have a really hard time with, frankly. It's possible. I think people could probably succeed in getting a crop of apricots every now and then here, but it is very hard because the climate, because of those climate differences. It's not a question of the plant being hardy along the Gulf Coast to winter. It's really a matter of the humidity, a whole bunch of other issues. So what else do I need to say? Speaking of winter squash, looking forward to my, from David, looking forward to my volunteer green stripe Kushaw this fall and winter. Kushaw squash, not Kushaw. Kushaw, says David Hubble. It's another winter squash that can be grown well. Kushaw, C-U-S-H-A-W. Fun one to play with. There is, who sent this? Bruce sent me a picture of what looks like a hybrid that he had that was a Korean squash crossed with a Seminole pumpkin. And it's funny looking. Started out round and is now oblong. So they will cross, those winter squash. Will they be better? I don't know. You can tell me whether you think they're better mature. I think if I'm growing a hybrid, I'm going to eat them very immature. They're going to be a little better. Is this fungus, heat stress, or something else? My two-year-old Japanese magnolia have the same thing on another opposite of the yard. Thanks, Doug. This is the tree. And I'm looking, I'm going to have to look closely at this picture, and we may have to come back and look at it. It looks like some kind of powdery mildew. I'm trying to see if there's any magnolia scale. Oh, fiddle. Sorry, I lost that. There we go. That's the picture I wanted right there. This file attachment could not be open. Let's try it again. This file attachment could not be open. All right. I don't know why that one didn't open. So it looks like, it does look like a type of powdery mildew. I'm trying to figure out why. It just seems to be on certain areas. So let me do it. Would you send me that picture again next week when we have more time to think about it and look at it and give a remedy for it? Because I'm not sure I'm seeing enough of it, and one of the pictures didn't come through. So there it is. Let me just send that again next week. Where did we get started this week? We started with, and you know, it didn't really, it didn't really hit home, I guess. But I am thinking about understanding where you are. And if you're going in the woods, if you're a hunter and you're thinking about things in the woods, it's just like we were talking about with the peaches. You know, you read about peaches on Facebook and you say, I'm going to grow this peach because this person in Minnesota is growing a peach and I'm going to, or wherever, Kansas or Indiana. And I'm going to grow that peach here because it did so well for them. You know, we're kind of the same way when we're with hunting. We've missed the boat because we don't realize that what we have here is very important. It's not what we bring in. It's what we have already in Alabama. And we've just barely begun to explore it. So I'm encouraging our new hunting club to think about where they are. I said there's 12 species, different species of oaks out here. And they said, huh? And I said, yeah. And you know, they're all going to produce acorns in a different way. And the deer are going to eat the acorns in a different way. I mean, some they won't even touch. They'd have to be so desperate to eat the mountain oak acorns. They just won't even mountain rock oak. They just won't even touch them. And they're big and they look and say, well, God, the deer are going to love these. No, they don't. They hate them. I don't know why they hate them, but they hate them. Maybe too many tannins. I haven't asked the deer yet. I'll have to ask them sometime. But they won't touch them. That tells you a lot. They're talking to you. And that's why you see so many of them. And a lot of other acorns that you don't see, well, what were they? What tree did they come from? Because they're not there anymore. The deer are eating them all. Well, what trees are those? You want to know, don't you, if you're doing the deer? And here's the other thing is that it may be that some oaks might actually be more valuable to deer, not for the acorns, but for the young growth. Where are we? We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.